For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to introduce our speaker tonight. Ko Carol Larson is very experienced Zen practitioner, has done much practice at Green Gulch and other places, and is a fellow student with me of Reb Anderson. Ko is also on the board of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and along with being an experienced Zen person, she's also a member of the Friends Meeting, or Quakers, in Cleveland, where she is. And so she has interesting perspectives. Ko, thank you very much for speaking this evening.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for inviting me and for your kind attention. Doing these talks is such a wonderful way to figure out what's important to me and to express. So just to give you a little foretaste, is we're going to go really big. We're going to do some roaming and playing, if not in samadhi, but in a samadhi adjacent realm, or attending to samadhi in some way, some mysterious way. I've titled the talk Peeking Behind the Facade, Seeking the Source. And for this talk, I'm thinking about the facade as being a linguistic facade, the facade of language. And one of the things that I cherish about Zen practice is it works with language on so many interesting levels, including saying that it's not, memorizing things is not going to give you the truth. It will point you to something and you need to drop the words at some point. One of the reasons that I thought of this talk was when Tygen asked me, I was reading a novel called Euphoria, and it's the story of early anthropologists. And this is, again, a fictionalized anthropologist, but I thought the perspective was so interesting. She had gone into what the European anthropologists were considering a primitive society, getting to know the people there. And she's had just found someone to teach her the language. She was just beginning to learn the language of the people she was studying with. And she says, "I am learning the chopped rhythm of their talk, the sound of their laughter, the cant of their heads. I can feel the relationships, the likes and dislikes in a room the way I never could if I could speak. You don't realize how language actually interferes with communication until you don't have it, how it gets in the way like an over-dominant sense. You have to pay much more attention to everything else when you can't understand the words. Once comprehension comes, so much else falls away. You then rely on their words, and words aren't always the most reliable thing." Which made me think about Sesshin. When we have the noble silence, that we're not relying on words, we're relying on a tradition and a form and the breath of our neighbor and the cant of a head of someone across the way. So I really cherish the way that Zen practice helps bring back the things we lose when we gain language. Of course, when we gain language, we gain a huge amount. But there's also something that has to be struggled to be regained once you rely on these symbolic words. And now onto the symbolic words for the rest of the talk. The other thing in my title had to do with seeking the source. In Tygen's mysterious pivot talk a few weeks ago, or a week or so ago, He spoke of the subtle radiance here before the beginning. And yesterday he spoke of Source as the ultimate universal reality. So I'm thinking about what is this reality, this universal reality? And I drop into my Meiwei's early language of science. Science was very reinforced in my upbringing and also in my later training. And so cosmologists say that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And through most of that time, there was, as far as we know, no language. So what was the nature of this reality that existed for such an incredibly long time, certainly from our human perspective? The Earth, they say, is 4.5 billion years old. And life, they're now finding rock fossils. It took a while to get bones and hard things to find in the fossil record, but they're finding evidence of softer life forms as far back as 3.5 billion years old, even perhaps as far back as 4.1 billion years old. Now, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, life started evolving pretty darn quickly. Again, not in the recognizable forms that we have here, but thinking about that, I remember a recorded talk of Alan Watts that I heard that was about an analogy between the Earth and apple trees. And he talked about apple trees. If you saw it in wintertime, you would think, oh, this is a relatively dead stick standing up here. And then as time goes on, it starts appling. And so in the same way that dead tree was given the right conditions, was going to bring forth apples, the Earth peopled. It was peopling. And if an advanced alien had come by, you know, 1 billion years into the existence of Earth, it would look and say, ah, a dead planet. There's nothing interesting here. But if it came back today, it would say, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It was peopling. It was just taking some time to create some interesting life forms. And again, not to be caught up in people. It was also, Alan Watts only talked about peopling, but it also is Norfolk pining and brine shrimping. And it's just creating all of this huge stuff. And it's coming out of the Earth. It isn't an addition to, it is the nature of Earth. So along those lines, I start thinking about there's something in science that's called the consciousness problem. Does consciousness come out of matter? Does consciousness come before matter? And those are the two big interpretations. So science, the traditional science, thinks of consciousness as coming out of a sufficiently complex thing like the brain. But that matter itself has no consciousness, and then it becomes an emergent property from a complex structure of matter. The traditional Vedantic philosophy and Christian philosophy have consciousness first, and then matter comes. That consciousness predates matter. But there's a third way of looking at it as consciousness and matter are co-emergent, that they are of each other. They cannot exist without each other in a sense. And I know I'm going way out there, but I really enjoyed this not-two-ness of consciousness and matter, that the nature of these things is to express in us because we're here. I mean, it's undeniable in that way. So thinking about how do we, and that's again a lot of verbiage. And our Zen tradition tells us, what is it to go underneath the words, that the words cannot take us there. And thinking about this, there's two pieces that are echoing. I know that the Sangha, Ancient Dragon, has been steeped in Hongzhe. And I was hoping to just hold up two lines from the Guidepost of Silent Illumination. The first line of silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. And then the other line is about half the page down of endless kalpas are totally empty, all things completely the same. So these are these huge kalpas that we have come from, that we have are intermingled with. Again, we're getting into the place where the words can't reach. So I went to one of the sources that I enjoy looking for lesser known stories, The Hidden Lamp. And I came upon Du Nan's Without Words, which is from Vietnam in the 11th century. Master Du Nan was the leader of a convent. She preferred silence. She was averse to sound and form, words and speech. A student was meeting with her and quoted the words of Virmalakirti from the Virmalakirti Sutra. I am sick because all beings are sick. Then the student asked, why do you have an aversion to sound and form? Du Nan quoted the Diamond Sutra saying, if someone sees me through form or looks for me through sound, that person is following a wrong path and cannot see the Tathagata. The student then asked, why don't you speak? And Du Nan said, the path is fundamentally without words. And I sort of love this, partly because the student first comes to her kind of wanting to show that he understood the Virmalakirti Sutra. He'd been reading it. He memorized it. He had that language. And then she quoted back the Diamond Sutra from the same sort of literary tradition, is speaking to a literary tradition. But then when he asked the, why don't you speak? I mean, it felt so heartfelt to me. And she didn't remain silent. She realized that words were, well, not the ultimate, they were necessary, and says, the path is fundamentally without words. She still pointed him away from being dependent on words, but it was I felt it was such a kindness to this young student's request. So I actually wanted to find out more about her. And so I looked up, and there's not a whole lot about this 11th century Vietnamese nun. But I found one series of poems from that period in Vietnam. And I've got to say that the Vietnamese Sangha really had some profound understandings. A lot of language, again, I think of the difference between prose and poetry. Prose, you want to be pretty exact and you want to refer to things as they are, prosaic as it were. But poetry tries to talk about things that are ineffable, that do go beyond language. So there's a series of poems, and I'm going to read three of them. There's two that I found on the way to her final poem. But I'm going to read them twice. There's two different translations. So I'll read the translation, the first translation, and then the second translation of each of them. This is from Chang Kong, who lived from 1046 to 1100. The subtle, miraculous emptiness is present every day. It's behind the harmonizing whirlwind in the world. Everyone knows the blessings of unconditioned wisdom, but unless one realizes it and makes it one's home, it's useless. And the other, again, slightly different perspective translation is, each day, the miracle of emptiness, the whirlwind that sings up the world. You say you know the blessing of its presence, but with what do you build your home? So again, I think these are source poems talking about this miracle of emptiness as the whirlwind that sings up the world. And we all know the presence. Then there's one by Master Chu Qi. Knowing from the guts that mind and body are non-arising, from it evolves wondrously all phenomenon. Affirmation of negative, all will come from it. From it are born billions and billions of universes. Its presence fills up all empty space, yet nowhere does it have any shape or form. Eons of lifetimes cannot compare with it. Here, there, everywhere. It is always luminous. And again, just to get a slightly different perspective with this second translation, deep inside, mind and body are one and empty. From its stillness, the brilliance of the world arrives. From its stillness, yes and no, and the innumerable universes are born. Space's vast emptiness brims over with its presence, yet nowhere does it stop to take shape or form. Countless lifetimes born and dissolving to make a single moment of its luminous calm. And then back to Diu Nan, whose story we got from the Hidden Lamp. It's the farewell advice to disciples. Birth, old age, sickness, death. It has been the rule since immemorial. The more one hopes to escape, the more one is caught in the net. Due to confusion, one seeks Buddha. Due to errors, one runs after Zen, seeking neither Buddha nor Zen, lips pursed, saying nothing. So this is Memorial Day. And this was, again, from the two little snippets I know of her, a beautiful teacher who was passing. Knowing that birth, old age, sickness, and death could not be escaped from. And the more we fight it, the more tangled we get. That often the times we want to chase after or grab the Buddha, or we seek the way of Zen, those are both errors. There's something that can be found by not pursuing, but simply resting and saying nothing. And yet, we need the verbal encouragement. We need the pointers. We can get so lost in so many things without the language. I'm going to take from these big ideas into a personal place for me. The person that I am still memorializing is my brother. My brother just passed this last January. And he was a veteran. He was the cusp year of the Vietnam War. He got his draft number. I recently found his draft card. And while not drafted, he did enlist. He didn't go to Vietnam. He served in Eastern Europe and don't need to go too far down there. My brother and I were not close. He was, through his teens, he was not a happy person. And as a not happy male teen, he tended to flack out on my other brother, who's also younger than him, and myself. Once he went into service, I pursued different ways of seeing the world, and we didn't converse much at all. And then last fall, he was diagnosed with bladder cancer. And he also was a person who would not use the internet. And he never married. He didn't have children. And I was given the role of his power of attorney for healthcare. So I was now in this intimate connection with my brother, who I'd had passing holiday relationship with, but you know, a lot of it was his mocking me for not knowing what sports teams were doing. Kind of an edge with all of that. As he came to the end of his life, he would come up and he would stop at my house before we go to the Cleveland Clinic. His cancer was so far advanced. He's from Canton, which is about an hour's drive south of where I live up in Cleveland. And because it was so advanced, he was coming up to the Cleveland Clinic for treatment. So he'd drive up, stop at my house for a little while, we'd visit, and then he'd go off to either his doctor's appointments or later on his chemo. And he would bring a banana initially for himself to eat, but then he found out that my three-year-old daughter liked bananas. And he would bring bananas for Amaya. Pretty consistently, and then more than what she could even eat, he just started bringing volumes of bananas because that's something he could do. And one Friday, we went to the hospital, and his numbers were not good enough to get the treatment. In fact, they wanted to hospitalize him that night, which he was resistant to, and. But he was also losing his ability to walk. He lived alone, couldn't care for himself. So collectively, my other brother, sister-in-law, and I helped him find a room. And then the next morning, my brother and sister-in-law went back home. The next morning when I came, he was no longer in the regular hospital room. He was in the ICU. And he was in the ICU in a very quiet ICU. My experience with ICUs in the past had been kind of loud and active, and this one was a very quiet ICU unit. And I was looking at his numbers, so because I had his power of attorney, I was also looking at his my chart, because I was the one who would interpret that for him, had done that for the last several months. And we came down to the point where his numbers, his kidney function numbers were going in a direction that was unsustainable. And slowly he went from our having near misses in our attempts to communicate to his becoming silent, his closing his eyes, and this 4 hours during which time he didn't open his eyes. And he got quieter and quieter and stiller and stiller. And I felt like I had kind of dropped into Sesshin mind, the mind that you get on day 3 of Sesshin. There was a profound stillness and also the sense that one's pores are open. And I had in those last few hours with my brother a communion, a way of touching one another, because the possibility of speech was no longer given to us. And again, I am so grateful for practice for giving me a way of negotiating that moment with an open heart that I'm not sure I would have had had I not had the experience of practices with everyone. Several days ago, I had a conversation with my three-year-old, and I will say that there's not much better conversations to be had about the great matter of birth and death than with a three-year-old. She's been struggling to figure out where her Uncle Dave went, and we had gotten a banana out. She wanted a banana that he hadn't gotten because it's been 4 months, but we were opening it Uncle David's way, which is opening it from the bottom rather than from the stem. Uncle David taught her to open it from the bottom because that's an easier way to get into it. So we were opening it Uncle David's way, and she goes, "Uncle David, he's not in his body?" "Yep, Uncle David is not in his body. That's the way we've chosen to express to her that what had happened to him. He's no longer in his body." And she's like, "Where is he?" And my response was to say, "You know, we don't know. There are lots of people who make up stories about where you go after you die, but it's we don't know. It's not something we get to know." And let's see, I've got to get this right. So, don't know. I wrote this down right after it happened. It's like, is this okay? This is gold. So she asked me then, "Where do you think he is? And what's he doing? Where do you think he is? What do you think he's doing?" And I just said to her again, I don't know, honey. This is not something we're given to know." And then she says, "Let's make up a story." So that's what people do. And I haven't come up with a really good story, but I've been, I have this little group I meet with every other Monday, Thich Nhat Hanh's No Death, No Fear, we've been reading. And again, last Monday, we happened to read this section, and I think it's one of the best stories I've come upon to, "Where's Uncle David?" She can't, she's not quite ready for it yet at three, but this is, helps me. "Looking deeply into a flower, we see that a flower is made of non-flower elements. We can describe the flower as being full of everything. There is nothing that is not present in the flower. We see sunshine, we see the rain, we see clouds, we see the earth, and we also see time and space in the flower. A flower, like everything else, is made entirely of non-flower elements. The whole cosmos has come together in order to help the flower manifest herself. The flower is full of everything except one thing, a separate self, a separate identity." And again, I want to go back to the sentence. "The whole cosmos has come together in order to help the flower manifest herself." Just as Uncle David, as part of the cosmos, has come together to call her into existence. So Uncle David is in her. He's in me. He's, again, in the clouds and sunshine. He's where he always was, in many ways. Although he doesn't bring bananas anymore, or at least not in the way she's used to. I think I want to end with one of my favorite stories about Ramana Maharshi, who is an Indian saint of the 20th century. And the story is told that as he was dying, also of cancer, as he was dying, his disciples were crying around him and saying, "Don't go, don't go, don't go." And he looked at them like they're crazy. And he says, "What are you talking about? Where would I go? We're all here. We're all part of each other. Thank you all for being part of me. And I welcome any responses, reflections, or questions that I can stumble over." Thank you, friends.
Loco.
Hi.
Hogetsu.
Hi, Hogetsu.
Hello. There's a lifetime of teachings in what you expressed today. The first thing, and I just love the kind of co-creation image. I was thinking about how Zen mind, beginner's mind, starts with this quote. I think it is wisdom that seeks wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if, you know, like, that's this kind of relational, constant communion, really, coming together in communion, and just really felt like that was really amplified in what you offered, and I appreciate that so much. I also thought of the lines, ba ba wa wa, is anything said about daughter? And the third thing that came to mind was, came to heart mind, was I wonder what your thoughts were, and anyone's thoughts really, about, you know, you speak of silence and stillness. And with the advent of our Zoom communication, together, but, you know, in some ways the feeling, at least for me, is challenged by this medium that we're communicating in that seems to call for words. And I wondered about silence and stillness in the age of virtual zazen and practice. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I completely share the challenge. I find it incredibly challenging. I went to one retreat since COVID back in February, and it was like, I'm so grateful that there's this portal when I'm here in Cleveland and I don't have a Sangha particularly that I can work with in this tradition. It's been a gift, but going from this to an actual retreat, again, with Reb, so that's always extra special for me. It felt like the difference between a blurry black and white and back to color. Back I'm a visceral person, and I do take things in from my pores. And the screen does not give me what I most long for, which is people in the room. And I don't know what it is in the room that is co-shared and settled. And I do get it at my Quaker meeting as well, that there's bodies together settling that interpenetrate in a way that doesn't happen for me over the screen. And I have heard of people that it has happened to.
Yeah.
And that's great, but that's a challenge. As to silence and stillness, I think that while Zoom does call for language perhaps more than just sitting with someone holding their hand, it again, sitting with you all in meditation today did remind me how silence and stillness act through me and act through others. And again, I'd be happy to hear anybody else's comments also.
David Ray. Thank you, Carl. David Ray has
thank you so much. So first I want to say a thing about sound and silence, and it's a story about what's going on in our weekdays in the Sangha that people might not know. So Mark Split, not that long ago, started taking one of the weekday mornings, and he had all been doing the thing after the Zazen bell of all saying, "Good morning, everyone. I'm now going to share the chant and the scripture." And Mark, the first time he came on as the Zoom go on, after the Zazen bell, he didn't say a word. He just shared the chant And I'm almost going to cry because it was so beautiful that we realized, oh, we've been doing this for 3 years now. We all know the deal. We don't have to do it. We can just be in silence together. And it, you know, feels more like being in a zendo together. It's just really beautiful.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. I want to say one more thing, and that's the word that I'm going to take away from your talk is apple, because I love those verbs. I love Chinese does this and English does it. We can just turn nouns into verbs without changing the form, you know? The reason we have apples is because apple's apple.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Thank you.
And that the appling is always going on. That it's not just when it's ripe, then it is appled. The appling is happening when the sap's going up and down in the wintertime, and that's the apple also. Mm-hmm.
David Weiner has something.
Yeah. Thank you, Ko, for many things. One, for sharing your openness about your brother and that experience. Thank you for your courage in doing that. The two things, and then I have two quick things and a question to ask, if I may. One is in the beginning of Paul Repp's book, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, he talks how a teacher was talking, saying goodbye to his students, and one came and said something very profound, and he said, "You are my flesh." Another came and said something even more profound, and he said, "Oh, you are my bones." And the third student came and bowed and said nothing, and he said, "You are my marrow." And, you know, sometimes the silence is more important. And living in for a long time, a lot of times in faculty meetings, we'd be talking, and then everybody would be quiet for a minute, or two, or three, or four. And it was arage, which means stomach words. So in the stomach, your source of being, you know, whereas we have a tendency to think of our heart or our mind as the source of our being. In Japan, it's your umbilical cord, you know, down here in your... And amazing in faculty meetings, we'd all be silent, and then somebody would say something, and we all had the same thought. You know, it's like we had intuitively, that thought had circled in silence among all of us. Mm-hmm. And that moment of silence, that harage, that our stomachs were talking to each other, our essence was talking to each other. The question I have for you, I think that for me, especially because of the studies that I'm doing and the work that I'm doing, what comes up a lot about is communion, and that we are not separate. We are all interconnected. Mm-hmm. Especially this last semester, I took a course on sacraments, and almost all the sacraments from various teachers' point of view is they're all trying to bring us into communion. Question. How do you see communion relating to what you are saying? That sense of connection to one another.
I think it's even deeper than the connection. Because you think of connection to one another, you assume that we're different and then there's little pathways.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we are each other.
Yeah.
We're not two. And of course we are. I mean, we get in different cars and drive to different addresses, and you know, that there's, but in some sense, that's the superficial piece of who we are. What we are is each other.
Yeah.
And again, not just the human world. That I love that Thich Nhat Hanh acknowledges the sunshine and the clouds and, you know, the crap in the soil that's going to make it fertile, that we're all of that, and take away any piece of it and we're not us, and take us away and you're not you. That and I also want to ask you, what faculty meeting? That sounds like such a fabulous faculty that you have the gut communication going on, because most faculty meetings that I've known of stay up in the chitter chatter and the putting paws on each other to get a little more status. But what a beautiful community you happen to be part of. 3 minutes of silence in a faculty meeting? That's a phenomenal.
Yeah, it's usually we're talking about a student and what to do with the student. And so without, you know, just the, there's lots of Japanese culture that goes into it. Like you hold back because you don't want to seem like you're the egotistical one who's going to fix everything. You know, you're trying to be humble. But it is really of just trying to get a sense of one another, of what to do with the student. And so there's other cultural factors in here, but it is trying to communicate with each other in silence. Which we think is the best.
Which is the Quaker business meeting, that we don't come to unit. We come to unity. We don't. It's not consensus that when Quakers make decisions, it's not through consensus. It's through listening deeply in the silence and coming to unity. Yeah. So I just love that these forms that you think are particular to one culture arise when people surrender to the truth of how we are intermade.
And something like death has a profound impact on that, because that's what I'm doing. And I'm in rooms with people who are dying, and sometimes silence. It's just silence. And you say a prayer. When I say prayers, I have long spaces between the words. I let them sit. And, you know, it's just that, you know, I'm asking you about community. I know how I feel about it. It's that sense of being one. You're not separate. Mm-hmm. And that's why I asked the question.
Did Ishan have a question? We're kind of moving along. So...
I was going to cede my opportunity because I know we're kind of moving along in the time, and so that's okay.
I would love to hear what you were going to say, if you wanted to do a short version.
Sure. First of all, I really, really appreciated your talk, Ko, and there was a lot there. And I also really appreciate opportunities to encounter silence and the space beyond words. And I just wanted to say that for me, I find that easiest to do in nature, that there's something about being... It gives me more of a sense that I'm part of something, you know, and can let go of some of my faculties to be outside rather than in a, you know, maybe still room. And so, I think that's all I wanted to say. But I think it's so important because words are not ever, you know, the thing. Their words are not the thing they describe. Words are not an experience. I guess they can be an experience, but we need to have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
And our habit is to oftentimes substitute words for the experience and think that we've had the experience if we have seen the words or, yeah. And I also, the sitting with nature has so much experience non-linguistically, right? And it's a really complex structure. It's in and of itself. An ecosystem is phenomenal. So, and it does that without language. So it can communicate that, I think.
I wanted to just like, I know we have to move along, but I wanted to just say, Ishan, this is a great segue. We'll do more announcements later. But Ishan is going to lead an outdoor sitting, a sesshin, at the end of July. And I just think this is a great advertisement for that. And also, I don't know if anyone online could hear this, but this evening there was thunder rolling by, there were birds, and the sendo we're in invites a lot of natural sound in the midst of our silence. So in some ways, I often feel like we are sitting here in nature, but still we crave more, and we'll have an outdoor sashin. So thank you, Aishin and Co.
That is actually one of my favorite things about sitting in the Lincoln Square Zendo, is that we have the windows open and the birds can pull you back to the present.
Thank you. I do think it's time for...
So we'll say the four vows.
The four vows. And then, then we'll have announcements.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to cut through them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.